US GAAP, like IFRS, also supports control by a group of individuals. When lineal family members, including spouses and their children, but excluding grandchildren, own more than 50% of the voting shares in each entity, they are regarded as a controlling entity, unless there is evidence that the members are not to collectively exercise their voting rights. However, there may be a case where the ownership of entities is divided among siblings and their children in a variety of forms. In such a case, discrete care is needed in identifying the substance of ownership. Consequently, IFRS and US GAAP are almost similar regarding the criterion about group of individuals. I emphasize again that when a single decision-making party composed of an individual or group of individuals is an ultimate controlling shareholder, it is considerably difficult to identify the existence of common control. Thus, an important part of the criterion for identifying common control may be the criterion about group of individuals. While the scope of group of individuals can be clearly defined when there is a contractual arrangement among the individuals of the group, there are many cases where a group of individuals is composed of close relatives with no contractual arrangement among them. Therefore, various views may exist regarding how close the relatives should be not to require a contractual arrangement when determining them as a group of individuals holding common control. As I mentioned in the previous phase, under US GAAP, a contractual arrangement is not required for lineal family members. And under IFRS, though there is no explicit standard, similar interpretation as that of US GAAP are given in accounting firm manuals. While both standards state that specific circumstances should be taken into consideration when a group of individuals is composed of siblings and their children in a variety of manners, neither of the standards provide detailed criterion for this issue. When determining the scope of common control, the criterion for identifying the scope of a group of individuals is very important. This is because if such criterion is not explicitly provided, there may be divergent interpretations depending on how far the scope of close relative covers and who should be subject to having a contractual arrangement. The divergent interpretation would lead to divergent in determining the scope of UCC transactions and also undermine comparability among entities. Therefore, with respect to the criterion for identifying common control, the following question should be discussed. Question 2.1. Is it necessary to explicitly provide a criterion for identifying common control? For example, criterion for determining the scope of a group of individuals. Question 2.2. If so, to what extent, in your opinion, should the scope of close relative, where a contractual arrangement is not needed, cover in relation to the criterion for determining the scope of a group of individuals? If, for example, where a group of individuals is composed of siblings. Because nowadays, they are not good relation between the siblings, yeah. Or sometimes they always fight to have more power. And last question is, what other areas should the criteria for identifying common control be provided for other than the scope of a group of individuals? For example, transitory control. So, let's discuss.
Comments, reactions?
I believe that there is a need to have a criterion. That's the first answer. The topic about relatives may not be necessarily the only one, because we have the case in Mexico, two brother and sister fighting against each other. Then it depends if they have the intention or the will to work together and to vote together. And if we have to discuss relatives, perhaps what is stated in IAS 24 about who is a relative and who is a good point to start. Yes.
Yeah.
Can I?
Domingo, and then
I think it's not useful to prepare a very detailed definition of common control. Probably, I think this is substance over form issue. The important is if they are acting as a group. So I think the definition can include some guidance about when we can have a presumption that they are acting as a group, but the I think just as a guide.
My comment is in the same direction. It's more important to have a common sense agreement to operate together, even if different friends, for example, very common in professional practice, you have a different structure and different people, not friends, not family, but they have the same objective. So this would be in the scope of a definition of common control. Right, it would be guidance instead of putting a long list of situations.
Others? Yes, please.
那么首先我们认为啊，有必要明确地提出识别同一控制的标准，它的意义呢，就是能够有助于防止同一控制交易的有关规定被滥用。
We think it's important to have this standard to UCC because that can avoid that something may be used for hazardous waste.
那么其次呢，是在关于没有合同安排的情况下，通过家庭关系来判断是否构成这个一组个体，那么可能会存在很多不可控的主观因素。
Besides using only the contract to define if the relative is one group, it will be possible to have other problems in this definition.
因此呢，我们建议啊，给出一个指导性的这样的一个判断要素，而不是说强制的规定在何种家庭关系下，它必然会。
So we suggest we can issue a kind of guidance to suggest what is considered this, and not to make a rule, something very fixed. Only this is UCC. So, just.
您说。还有一个方面呢，就是。 除了识别一组个体的范围以外，还应该要对这个实时控制的时间性要求，也就是说非暂时性的控制做出规定。那么现在呢，在中国，我们是规定非暂时性的控制通常为合并前后，同受同一控制满一年，以便于理解和操作。
Another thing is we need to identify the timing of this control. Okay, some non-temporary controls. In China, we consider 1 year before the merge or after, we need to put some timing as well.
但是呢，这种做法目前呢也有
But some enterprises has also complained with this kind of measurement. Only 1 year is a limit, may not be suitable for everybody.
Practice varies. It could be the wife and husband or mother-in-law and son-in-law working together. Depending on jurisdictions, it could be different formalities between partners. Two friends may have a contract or may not have a contract. In Russia, the practice is such that not many arrangements are formally documented. And often this arrangement could be formalized the way which is not accepted under Russian regulation. And I believe that in many countries, situation is similar. And we should not follow a very strict American approach or very sophisticated Chinese approach. What I would rather prefer to look at substance and to have this approach to identify whether the common control exists, what form the group of the individuals who exercise this common control. So the substance matters rather than formal side.
It occurs to me, and I should have asked you to do this initially, someday somebody's going to actually want to listen to the recording of this. We should probably, when we speak, introduce ourselves so that the people who listen later know who's speaking. But Pavna?
It would be easy if you introduce people.
If I introduce you, we've already demonstrated my ability to goof up the names. So,
so let me start with that. I'm Bhavna Doshi from India. Besides the financial control, that is holding more than 50% by an individual or an entity, I would like to sort of endorse the view which was expressed by Argentina as well as you gentlemen there. And we in India have a securities exchange board which controls transactions of listed company, and they have a term which they use, group. And that group, one needs to specify in advance what that group is. So it could include people who have agreed to commonly act together, work together. So it could be friends, it could be other parties in the group. So if we could look at something of that sort, which would be more of substance over form, as all are seeing.
In wearing my hat as the chairman of the Interpretations Committee, I always worry about substance over form. It frequently is code for, I sure wish this transaction wasn't what it actually is and it was something else, or that the contract hadn't been written the way it was. That's a personal view. Let me ask this question a little bit differently. What if Avinash and Domingo and I, without a contract, each decide to acquire a third of a public company? Now, the reason we did that is that we hope 2 years from now to take it back public. So this is a private equity transaction. We're not relatives. We don't have a contract, but we are acting together. In your minds, would you apply the same principle, the same thought process that you would have applied had we been relatives? Or do you say, no, they're just three guys? And
not necessarily, because sometimes you have a group working together just in one business, but they are not working together in all business. They are competitors in other kind of business. So you have to look and see what's happening at this time in this situation. In Brazil, for example, we use the common control. Even in the law, we have the concept of common control, and it's under Vision A, and we have a definition of control. And you have the mentions of the shareholders' agreements and so on, and you go finally in the right of voting, the voting rights, and the use of the vote right. Because sometimes you have the right, but you don't use. Someone else is using. Okay? You just leave the other people to decide. So we have this including in the law, just to define who is the person or the groups of persons or the entity that controls, because there are legal penalties for some acts of the controller.
The reason I ask the question, let's take the example of the three of us acting in concert but without a contract. Third, a third, a third, none of us are in control, according to IFRS. So, the question is, when this company subsequently is put back to the public, what's the measurement basis of its assets and liabilities? Is the measurement basis the same? Is it just old historical cost? Carry over from when it was a public to a private back to a public? Or is there a basis for saying, no, you people acted in concert with one another, and therefore there should be new bases? So that's why I think this question is number one, broader than just family. But very, very difficult, absent very detailed rules, and I think that's what Kirill was referring to. In the United States, the rules on this are incredibly mechanical and detailed, and they're SEC rules, not FASB rules. But
thanks, Jay. I think, yeah, just to respond to your two points, the first one, when you were saying, pardon? Oh, sorry, Kim Bromfield from South Africa. Just to respond to some of your comments, when you were saying that the three of you were acting together, I guess the question is, well, what evidence is that? So when you do now come to have a meeting, you know, what requires you to vote the same way as your other two shareholders? So is there some kind of verbal agreement? Is there evidence that you really are acting in concert, or do you simply each just own a third, a third, a third, but you can each apply your mind independently? So I think that maybe it goes back again to the definition of control, and you know, if we're looking at specifically in IFRS 10 now, you know, it goes back to, well, in reality, who is controlling? And so in reality, are you all working together by some unwritten contractual agreement or something like that? Or can Domingo decide, well, he's going to vote one way and you might decide to vote the other way, and then Bhavna's going to decide which way she's going to vote, and you just might happen to all vote the same way, but there's nothing really requiring you to. So I think for me it has to come back to, is there something which really evidences that you are acting in concert whereby you've undertaken to all vote the same way? So I think it goes back to, I guess, the principle of, you know, de facto control in IFRS 10, is there really, in fact, some, you know, requirement or understanding that you are going to all act together? And so I think, you know, in terms of the definition, it really needs to have a principle as opposed to, I think, a whole lot of rules as to say, well, just because perhaps your family, you are deemed to act together, maybe there could be a presumption, but maybe it could be rebutted in certain instances. But then just because you're not family doesn't mean that without a written contract you're not necessarily acting together. So I think it's, I mean, again, I think in practice it could be challenging, but I think that there should be some principles around saying, well, are you in fact somehow bound to act together?
What would those principles be? How would you define the principle that we're looking for here?
Well, I think for me it would be probably also an indication of what has happened in meetings in the past. And, you know, so again, to say, well, has anybody ever voted independently? And maybe, again, the test would be is maybe you propose something which Domingo doesn't really necessarily agree with. I think the test is going to therefore be, well, is he somehow compelled to vote the same way because there's some unwritten pact or not? So, and agreed, without something in writing, it certainly makes it more difficult, but I don't think something has to necessarily be in writing. It could just be based on practice or some understanding. Obviously, from an auditing perspective, yes, it makes it a whole lot more difficult to actually substantiate that. But I think that we're going to have those challenges in the control definition in IFRS 10 in terms of de facto control, is who in fact is controlling. So who in fact is acting together.
So the principle, I'm still fishing. You've given me a lot of examples of how you would attempt to make an evaluation, but is the principle that one ought to look for individuals or entities that act in concert with one another? And it's not limited to 3 or 6 or 8. It's in determining whether or not there is a group acting in control. Mm. And that's the thing we're looking for. That's the principle. That we're looking for a group acting in control. I hope somebody's writing this down. And it doesn't matter if they're family or not. Mm-hmm. But that the way we evaluate that is not the U.S. approach, which says if there are 3 or fewer, we assume. We can't do, I don't think we can do that in an IFRS context. But that one must make an evaluation at the beginning of thinking about the transaction and the accounting of whether or not there is a group acting in concert. Is that, I see a lot of heads going up and down. Has anybody got a problem with that? Okay.
Just the behavior.
Yep.
I think if you don't have a contract, you have to watch the behavior. If they are, probably in practice, it's not so difficult. It theoretically seems to be more complex to have a definition, but in practice, you can see they are acting as a group.
Even for consolidate, you don't need a contract. Why you should need a contract for a definition of control?
To support the view that we need to look into the past, into the practice, the way how the decisions are made, as the auditor who is auditing the financial statements prepared on the basis of the common control for many years, I would say that the evidence exists. And often you could find the arguments and the evidence base to conclude that there are common decisions and the common ruling of the business. So it is not so difficult. The matter is to what I'm repeating myself to find the substance. And the formalities are less important than the reality.
On here, we're ready to move on?
Let's move on to the next topic. This topic is the type of UCC transactions. We have finished over the concept of UCC transaction, and now we are going to technical issues for UCC transactions. UCC transactions refer to all transactions carried out between entities under common control, and they frequently occur in a variety of transactions formed according to various purposes, including tax savings, corporate reorganization. Therefore, UCC transactions include all transactions conducted between entities under common control, such as business combination under common control, spin-offs, and investments in kind. Let's start the BCUCC first. BCUCC may be divided into acquisition or disposal of shares, mergers, and acquisition or disposal of business. A good example regarding acquisition or disposal of shares is a group reorganization. Let's take a look at the figure on screen. This figure shows that if analyst C transports its entity D shares to entity B, entity D becomes a subsidiary of entity B. However, since entities B and C are under common control of entity A, the ultimate parent entity, this stock transfer is classified as a transaction under common control. Mergers among the ultimate parent company and subsidiaries or among subsidiaries are also examples of UCC transactions. Let's alter a few assumptions from this figure, such that company C, entity C acquires entity B by a merger. Such merger will change legal entities, but will not change any economic substance from the perspective of the ultimate parent entity, that is entity A. A transfer of a business from an entity to another entity under common control is also type of a UCC transaction, and the nature of the transaction is very similar to that of stock transfer. Next is spin-offs. It's very difficult, spin-offs. I think it's a little bit difficult concept and transition. Generally, spin-offs could be classified as type A spin-off and type B spin-off. First is type A spin-off. This occurs when a company spins off a business unit as a separate legal entity and owns shares issued by the new legal entity. If there is a parent subsidiary relationship between the existing company and the new company in the case of this spin-off, the transaction is a UCC transaction, even if the new entity is a separate legal entity. Second is type B spin-off. This occurs when a company spins off a business unit and swaps shares of the business unit with its own shares. In the case of pro rata type B spin-off, where existing shareholders distribute their shares to the new entity on a pro rata basis, existing shareholders keep risk and rewards of the existing entity after the spin-off. This transaction is nothing but a legal form change from one entity to multiple entities, and also is a good example of a UCC transaction. Also, a non-pro rata type B spin-off without control change is an example of a UCC transaction. Last is investment in kind. Investments in kind are essentially identical to type A spin-offs, in that the entity that provides investment in kind receives controlling shares. Therefore, investment in kind among entities under common control is also an example of a UCC transaction. While we classify UCC transactions into mergers, spin-offs, and other types, but actual UCC transactions take a combination of these transactions. Because entities often use UCC transactions as a means to execute corporate strategies such as restructuring, it is a very important point. Typical UCC transaction in practice is spin-off and simultaneous merger. In order to restructure the hierarchy among entities under common control,
an intermediate parent company spins off a business unit as a new entity. And then the new entity merges a subsidiary of another intermediate parent company. Let's look at the figure. Figure shows that P1 is the ultimate controlling entity, and that IP1 and IP2 are intermediate parent entities that own subsidiaries D1 and D3, respectively. For restructuring, the ultimate controlling entity made a decision to execute a spin-off, type A spin-off, such that IP1 spins off and creates a new grandson entity, D2. And D2 subsequently acquires D3, a subsidiary of IP2, for the completion of corporate restructuring. Similar to this transaction, other combinations of UCC transactions, such as business acquisition and simultaneous spin-off, or stock acquisition, merger, and simultaneous spin-off, could also be examples of UCC transactions, which are often executed to achieve corporate goals. So, transaction under common control has various types, and each type has a distinctive transaction structure. But the most common type is a business combination, which often includes merger, stock acquisition, and business acquisition. Therefore, some people argue that the UCC project should deal with only business combination under common control for a proposed set of accounting guidance due to time constraint and need to provide a timely accounting guidance. On the other hand, others maintain that the UCC project should address all UCC types in an inclusive manner, because first, UCC transaction frequently arise as a combination of various transactions like this. Second, accounting guidance specifically designed for BCUCC will cause an accounting divergence, for instance, between BCUCC and spin-off for one same transaction under common control. Therefore, I believe that the following discussion is necessary. Question 3.1. In the UCC project, should we include all UCC transaction types or all BCUCC per accounting principle methods and guidance? And then, another point is that because UCC transactions include mergers, spin-offs, stock transfers, and other transactions, and one UCC transaction often includes various forms of transaction, there must be one accounting treatment for all types of transactions. If there are alternative accounting treatments, for example, fair value method for spin-off and book value method for merger, an entity under common control might have an incentive to exploit accounting differences for each reporting purpose. For instance, an intermediate parent company merges its own subsidiary and spin-off again such that the unit takes advantage of the fair value basis. Thus, we need to discuss the following question. In the UCC project, should we provide a single accounting guidance for all types of UCC transactions? Or should we allow providing alternative methods for various types of UCC transactions? Yes, let's discuss.
Okay, could you go back to 3.1? I think we've already answered this one, haven't we? So I just wanted to get concurrence with that, so then 3.2, the question is, given the variety of transactions that fall within the scope that we've very loosely described, is it, I would phrase the question a little more pejoratively, is it possible to say that we have one accounting method for all of those, or are we going to have to slog through and deal with each and try and make, or at least identify, how we would make a decision? I'm seeing a lot of head nodding, but
I think we should preliminarily work with a principle. And maybe when we move to different transaction, we need to reassess this decision.
And what would the principle be?
In my view?
Yeah.
One accounting.
Oh, one account. Okay. I thought you were gonna I thought you were gonna tell me which one.
Well, yeah, well, we only made the question on scope, basically, right? So let's
Fair
move
enough.
To the other question, and I then try to respond.
Okay. Avinash?
Yeah. Do we need to ask this question at this stage, or should we first look into the various other aspects and come back to this question?
That's a possibility. That we withhold judgment on this one for the moment. I'm seeing a lot of heads nodding yes. Does anybody object to withholding judgment at this point?
To provide guidance for all types of UCC transaction can provide more consistency to the system.
但是同时也会无限扩大关于同一控制判断范围的争议.
But it can also take this measure very bigger than we hope, and to broad all the environment to our control.
那么目前中国的企业会计准则仅对同一控制下的企业合并做出了规定.
So actually in China we have only control only this for the merge of enterprises under UCC.
那么对其他类型的同一控制交易并没有单独的做出特别的规定.
For other kind of transaction under UCC we don't have special guidance for that right now.
在实务中，那么往往是按照企业啊，它是按照公司法等等相关的法律要求，对于分离经营、实物投资等等这样的交易，采用公允价值法，对企业合并采用账面价值法.
Normally, we use corporation law, and for merge of corporation, we use fair value method, and for spin-off, we use book value method. No, it's the opposite. The opposite. Sorry. For the merge, we use back, book value, and for spin-off, for fair value method.
Okay. I think the sense of the group is that we withhold judgment at this point. I do need to take a little bit of responsibility here, or the IASB needs to take some responsibility. The reason spinoffs are included in the paper is because when we started our project that we subsequently discontinued, a large number of our board members said you have to deal with both in the same package. So that's why they're in the paper and why the scope is the way it is. Was because I knew that when next we go to the board, those same board members are still going to be around and still insisting. So, shall we move on then?
Okay. Let's start.
The topic we discuss now is the accounting for UCC transactions in consolidated financial statement.
Let's look at the general accounting principles first. UCC analysis form a single economic analysis at conceptual level. It means that from the perspective of the ultimate controlling entity and the UCC structure, there are no economic substance changes for any UCC transactions. On the other hand, UCC transactions occur in many different forms in various circumstances. In addition, when a party to a UCC transaction is an intermediate foreign entity or subsidiary that is non-ultimate controlling entity, the UCC transaction may have economic substances from the perspective of that party. Following this logic from the perspective of the ultimate controlling entity, any UCC transaction should not bring any economic consequences, and therefore there must be no impact on the consolidated financial statement prepared by the ultimate controlling company. However, subsidiaries or intermediate parent entities might have two alternative viewpoints. First, one can argue that because subsidiaries are part of the UCC structure, subsidiaries should apply the same accounting treatment as the one applied by the ultimate controlling entity. This is view one. This view is based on proprietorship theory, which explains that to the extent that the controlling entity can exercise the control over subsidiaries, regardless of share percentage held by the controlling entities, subsidiaries are part of UCC entities. Second, an alternative view is that subsidiaries and intermediate parent entities are separate reporting entities and should provide financial reporting accordingly. This is view two. According to view two, if subsidiaries have non-controlling interests, they have reporting responsibility, not only for the controlling interests, but also for the non-controlling interests. In addition, if these subsidiaries had issued global bonds or convertible bonds, creditors also would be primary users of financial reporting. Therefore, from the perspective of non-controlling interests or creditors, transaction among subsidiary and UCC entities could be viewed as arm's length transactions. Consequently, UCC transactions could be treated as arm's length transactions that might have economic substance or economic impact on the financial statements of the reporting entity. The following table summarizes this argument. Can you see that table? The main point is the cross part between view 2 and subsidiaries. Financial reporting based on the assumption that subsidiaries and intermediate parent entities are separate reporting entities that are independent from the ultimate controlling entities or other subsidiaries. It is difficult, if not impossible, it is difficult to support either view one or view two unequivocally, and the choice between view one and view two would be boiled down to the demand of information user of the reporting entity. That is, if not controlling interests of subsidiaries are significant and non-controlling shareholders' information demand is high, then view 2 would be appropriate. Alternatively, if the controlling entities fully own subsidiaries, or if not controlling interests of subsidiaries are not important, then view 1 would be more relevant than view 2. Okay, let's illustrate this point by examining this case. There are two examples. An intermediate parent company acquired a business under common control and provided the subsidiary stock for consideration. Net assets and cash flows attributable to the intermediate parent company change due to this transaction. That means it has economic substance. Thus, this PCUC transaction has an economic substance for the reporting entity, which is an intermediate parent company. There are two examples led to this PCUC transaction. Here is example one, and next is example two. Do you grasp what difference is between two examples? Red line part is about the difference. Left and right side is before and after business acquisition. In this example, IP1 and S1 are fully owned by P1, and D1 and D2 are the fully owned subsidiary of IP1, and IP1 has no convertible bonds or public bonds. Now is the second example. Let's look at the differences. P1 has a 51% ownership in IP1 and S1. That is, non-controlling interests have a 49%. It's very significant. IP1 has a 51% ownership in D1, and IP1 also has considerable amount of convertible bonds and global bonds. And same BCUC transition occurred in both examples. By reviewing the two examples, I can ask a question. What accounting method should be used in IP1's consolidated financial statement? In order to answer the question, the analysis like the table is necessary. Factors to be considered: ultimate controlling shareholder. Example 1 is 100%. Example 2 is 51%. Non-controlling shareholders. Example 1 is no. Example 2 is 49%. It is significant. The creditors. Example 2 are very important. So, the table shows that in example 1, the major user of financial statement of IP1 is the ultimate controlling shareholder, that is P1. On the other hand, in example 2, the major users of the financial statement of IP1 are diverse, such as non-controlling shareholders, investors in convertible bonds, investors in publicly offered global bonds. Now, let's link the results of this analysis to viewpoints provided in page 24. This. And accounting treatments following view 1 and view 2 would be more appropriate for example 1 and example 2, respectively. In example 1, IP1's primary information user would be the ultimate controlling company. In this case, UCC transactions should not affect the financial reporting from the perspective of the ultimate controlling entity, because such transaction would not have any economic substance among UCC entities. Therefore, book value method would be an ideal choice for IP1, the party to this BCUCC transaction. In contrast, example 2 shows that IP1's primary information user is not only ultimate controlling shareholder, but also other constituents such as non-controlling shareholders, convertible bond investors, and global bond investors. Because all these other constituents are assumed to be important information users, IP1 could be better positioned to be a separate reporting entity, for which fair value method would be an appropriate accounting choice. For your information, details will be discussed in part 7 of the discussion paper. Most Korean UCC cases are like example 2, not example 1. Due to the corporate government system, market structure, and regulatory environment. Okay, relating to these general accounting principles for UCC transactions, we need to discuss the following questions. Do you agree that we dichotomize UCC cases into the UCC entity view and the separate reporting entity view, and provide two alternative accounting choices based on the analysis of the information users and their demand? Okay.
Before we get into the questions.
And the next question.
Oh, you wanted to go on. Let's do them one at a time.
Yeah.
So let's focus.
Question 4.
Okay. Let's take the questions one at a time. I would like to put a question to the group. When the board was dealing with some of these separate financial statement issues, we were told that there are many jurisdictions in which IP1 would be required to produce IFRS financial statements regardless of whether or not it had any external users, that the corporate law or whatever else would require that. Is that, can I just have a show of hands of jurisdictions in which that is true? Okay, I'm counting India, South Africa. It was Bob Garnett who raised the point, so I...
Historically, there are
companies. Okay. Argentina, Indonesia, Brazil, Mexico, so Russia. So almost everyone at the table faces the situation that even though IP1 has no external shareholders or lenders or anything else, it would have to prepare full IFRS with consolidation at its level. Okay? Given that, how do we answer 4.1? Carol, you were wanting to get in?
By asking this question, you imply the answer for this question. If there is a separate reporting entity on IP1 level, then you have to apply the rules which are given by IFRS 3. So from this point of view, from the legal point of view, yeah, we are binded. We're bound by these accounting rules. At the same time, if you look at this, it is a theoretical question which everybody has and which is asked all the time when you have these transactions. And you need to consider from the IFRS point of view whether the individual financial statements has its own value, whether it is just a park where you accumulate assets and liabilities of the group, or it should be considered from the broader point of view. And the legal aspect does matter, but I believe that it should be considered from the another point of view.
Point taken. Others?
Kim Bromfield from South Africa. Yeah, I guess a point that I would just like to raise would be is that maybe the transaction didn't take place buying shares. So, you know, IP1 might not actually be preparing consolidated financial statements. It just might be their separate financial statements because they've bought a business. So they may have just bought a division and not necessarily shares of an entity. And I think the concern is going to be, you know, do we end up by having a different treatment if you were to have bought the net assets versus buying the shares and making that distinction? So I must say at face value, my view wouldn't be to make a distinction based on who the shareholders are. you may find that in reality, if you have, you know, significant outside shareholders, maybe some of these transactions are more arm's length, perhaps, because you've got, you know, minority shareholders and there could be some protective rights, etc. So maybe they, you know, might not necessarily be on a non-arm's length basis. My other concern with making a distinction based on who the shareholders are in terms of the consequential accounting is what happens if initially or currently the entity is wholly owned and then subsequently there's a transaction, it goes back to your example with the third, and you said subsequently maybe you then decide to list that entity or whatever you decide to do. I think a concern that I have is surely we should be looking at the accounting for that entity regardless of who the shareholders are. So personally, I don't think that I would like to see a distinction made based on who the shareholders are.
Yeah, I think you have captured a view that I had bubbling around was that whether or not the thing had economic substance is independent of who the users of the financial statements are. So even if there are no external users of the financial statements, the transaction either does or doesn't have economic substance, which I think, Kim, is what you were driving at. Others? Please. Wong Hung.
Broadly speaking, when we have non-control rights in this situation, may occur some swap or changes in economic interests. Even there is no non-control right, can also bring some changes in interest in economy interest as well. For that, all transactions which carry kind of economic issues we need to put something to have some influence to guide these rules. So the view one is quite similar to what we apply now in China. The reason is control the financial statement is the center of our rule, that is the principle of our rule of control. So in this, under this view one, we think that it should consider the statement A for that. For the statement B, in some cases it may not be applied. For instance, the ultimate parent company, one holds two separate intermediary companies. Mm-hmm. Yeah, through these two intermediate parent companies to try to control the third party, the third company. And these two intermediate parent company doesn't have the whole control, the right of control. In this case, the plan B is not, I think, is not a play, it's not very good for this.
Others? Rosita, you want to come in?
Yes, Rosita from Indonesia. I think I would like to support Kim's view that when we decided where there is control or not, we have to consider who actually control this, the whole entities. So when we agree on that, then we don't need to dichotomize what will be the accounting treatment for the UCC based on entity few or separate reporting entity. Because when we decided the control aspect, we have considered that before that. So we support the view A, view one, yes.
Okay, so question 4.1 is represent view two, and question 4.2 represent view one. Yeah.
Are we all clear that we're now talking about the financial statements of the intermediate parent? We're not talking about any change in the financial reporting by the ultimate parent. Sure. We all know what that is. But we're talking about now the financial statements of the intermediate parent. Kim?
Kim Bromfield from South Africa. Yes, I guess just to touch on those two views, I say, while I certainly would not like to make a distinction based on who the shareholders are, I guess I do perhaps struggle with view one, which obviously decides on what the accounting is going to be given what the ultimate controlling entity applies. I think personally I would like to see the accounting by the entity being representative of that as an independent entity, but taking into account the common control transaction, and obviously we're still going to be getting into that discussion, but I think that I would rather like to see that as a standalone reporting entity, and it shouldn't necessarily be driven by the accounting of the ultimate parent.
Sorry. For example, in Brazil, during 2009 and 10 and 11, we were not recognizing any profit in transactions under common control. Depending if it was transaction between subsidiaries or between the parent company and subsidiaries, no profit. We are looking at the seller. Okay. No kind of transactions. Okay, inventory is real estate or partnerships, okay? But we had some problems with the minority interests in the subsidiaries. And from 2012 on, starting this year, we are not recognizing the profit when the parent sells, but we are recognizing the profit as independent parties if the subsidiaries make the sale to the parent company or among themselves. So we are looking at this, in this case, as separate reporting entities, okay?
We may have different views, right?
Yeah. No, we are we were using view one, yeah. And we had to change it to view two because of the problem with the minority interest.
When we discussed this,
we had to, okay.
When we discussed this at CPC, we didn't have a common view on that. So my view is that we should follow view one that you look to the ultimate parent company. And I don't like the idea of changing the carrying amount of assets and liabilities, neither if you have third party or not. Minority, they are minority. They don't control the transaction. So everything is performed under the control and direction of the major shareholder. That's why I think that we should try to avoid this. And we were discussing, we have a concept, a definition for economic substance, because we are providing a lot of definition on this guidance. Do we need a definition for economic substance? Because we are saying that we may accept a certain account if we have economic substance. So this may not be so clear what is economic substance. So despite the fact that I support view one, if we move to view two, we would need a very clear definition of what would be economic substance.
Avinash?
I want to raise another issue in this, which is connected with this, that here we are talking of a common ultimate parent, that which may be an entity which is preparing consolidated financial statements. Take the case of, say, the controller is the government. Now, if the controller is the government and there are two entities which are combining, so in that case, it may be difficult to support view two.
View one.
No.
It's his view.
So maybe it is.
Or even view two. As if it would support both.
Eliseo, when we made this change from view one to view two, we asked the international auditors to see what they were seeing in the world. And they brought the idea that in continental Europe, most of the countries were using view two. So that was one of the reasons we had to change. And it's interesting that even when we were under view one, we had some cases in Brazil in some kind of transactions between under common control that in the general meeting, the controller, he didn't vote. Okay, he voted as a controller, but not as the seller, for example, but not as the purchaser. And only the minority interest vote, and it was considered by the Brazilian Securities Exchange Commission as separate entities in this specific case.
Can I?
One more, and then we got to have somebody else in here.
Maybe, Kent, you make your question.
Yeah, Kim, observation.
Thank you. Kim Bromfield from South Africa. I think picking up on the last comment that was made, we certainly in our country have seen a lot of push in certain cases to actually treat that entity as a separate reporting entity for various economic reasons as well, because sometimes you may find that you've got the common control transaction, but they might have raised external funding. And if you end up by using the carrying values from the ultimate reporting entity, the financial statements of the other entity, you know, doesn't look so healthy because you've got the assets sitting at the historical or the carryover basis being a lot less than the financing. So on paper, the company looks like it's insolvent. And then you have to, you know, sort of say, but no, it isn't really, because these assets are worth a whole lot more, just that they were accounted for at this carryover basis. So that's why I think that, say, again, the concern is, you know, in different scenarios, people tend to want different answers. But as I don't think that those should drive it. I really think that there should be a common principle, and I guess maybe just to put a view forward, I actually think that in common control transactions, you've got two transactions. One being, let's say, the purchase or the sale of the assets, as if it were with a third party, you know, independent transaction, and then you've got the common control element. So I suppose in a way, if you think about, is it IFRIC 17 on the, is it IFRIC 17? I don't know, help me, is it IFRIC 17 or 18? 17, sorry, it is 17, thank you. Where although you've got the distribution of non-cash assets to shareholders, you actually view it as sort of two transactions, one being a sale on an arm's length basis at fair value, which you account for, and then you regard, you know, then you account for the distribution. So in a way, I would perhaps like to see common control transactions being accounted for on that basis, that you sort of see a transaction with a third party, and then you account for the common control element, which might result in a distribution or a notional capital contribution, depending upon if the transaction takes place at more or less than that it, what it would on an arm's length basis. And so that's why I think the one side of the transaction should be accounted for consistently, no matter who the parties are, no matter who the shareholders are, and then you account for that common control element, which reflects the fact that it could be off-market, would be my approach.
I was with you until you got to the end there. I think IFRIC 17 says you've got two events. One is the realization of the assets that are being distributed, which you account for at fair value. And at that point, then, the distribution is at market because you've marked up the assets, so there's no recognition of a non-market bit to it. I guess the question, though, is, and this goes back to the intercession from China, if there are no external users, and the fact of the matter is the intermediate parent is only preparing financials to satisfy a company law requirement, you're imposing a lot of cost on them to do an accounting that is never going to matter. That's one end. On the other hand, if I'm one of those minority shareholders in the intermediate parent, and you've done something that changes potentially the value of my investment, I, by God, want to know, and I want it accounted for properly. So it seems to me, how do we reconcile those two, what seem to be very reasonable positions in my mind? Kim?
If I can respond, I agree. I mean, I think obviously the cost-benefit analysis comes in, but if one does, just for a moment, put cost aside, I think the conceptual principle needs to be that that entity should account for the transaction. As you say, maybe currently there are no outside users of those financial statements, but what happens if there's a transaction in the future and now there are outside users? You now have these financial statements showing a different result to what they would have if they'd been outside users, you know, a few months prior to that. So I do accept that, yes, it would be costly, and I guess there would need to be a motivation as to why, even, you know, given the costs, it still is the right answer. But I do think conceptually, to me, it sounds like the right answer.
Point taken. Very strong point. We have 5 minutes before lunch, and I'm going to suggest that that's not enough time to raise a separate question, but I would invite anybody else on this one, or is my watch broken? I show 5 minutes till 12.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, none appearing, we will recess for lunch. And we'll give our friend a chance to recover his voice.
Hello, just a minute. Everybody is invited to have a lunch and third floor upstairs, okay? The Terrasso restaurant here in Renaissance. Yes, you can take that. Okay?